And now, Bill Resnick and Mary Ann Lloyd-Smith.
Hello, Mary Ann Lloyd-Smith. Welcome to KABU in Portland, Oregon, USA.
Thank you. Great to talk to you.
Mary Ann Lloyd-Smith got her PhD from the University of Technology in Australia. Over the years, she developed expertise in toxics and toxic waste management. She served on the UN Expert Group on Climate Change and Chemicals and is co-author of the report Climate Change and POPs, Predicting the Impact. A POP is a persistent organic pollutant. Sometimes they're called forever chemicals. They just keep accumulating at higher and higher levels. And she's a senior advisor to the National Toxic Network in Australia and other organizations. We're going to discuss pollution, all the dangerous stuff that our out-of-control economic systems are pouring into our land, waters, and atmosphere. These include, of course, the greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide and methane causing climate change, as well as many novel molecules, medicines, catalysts, pesticides, additives, flame retardants, on and on, all of this stuff, many synthesized by chemical engineers. And all these chemicals are circulating near everywhere in Earth now in some concentration. And yet, like the POPs, the persistent organic pollution, there really isn't careful research on their toxicity, and much less their possible interaction effects. Mary Ann Lloyd-Smith, the engineers, particularly the sewage engineers, once had this quip: the solution to pollution is dilution. Well, that day is gone, and we have to find some real solutions, and soon. You've, though, intensely examined pollution in oceans and its various effects, including on climate change.
Sure. Well, in 2018, we authored the Oceans Pollutant Guide, which looked at the range of pollutants affecting our oceans and affecting our waterways, and how those pollutants interact with the damage that climate change is doing to our aquatic ecosystems. And I think you touched on them in your introduction, but one of the ones, of course, we are most concerned about is the acidification of the oceans. Our oceans are now 26% more acidic than they were 100 or so years ago, and that's having a phenomenal effect on everything from our mollusks and our crabs, even to the way fish spawn. We've got problems with climate change increasing the mobilization of chemicals like POPs, as you described, the persistent organic pollutants, and others, which are called persistent bioaccumulative toxins. So these are just very serious toxins, which are also incredibly persistent. And what's happening is with the heating of the oceans, we're seeing a number of these being released from what we call the environmental sinks, from the ice and the snow. And not only does that just mean more exposure to both marine mammals and marine animals and humans to these chemicals, but the increased salinity, the increased heat, all affect the way chemicals degrade, the bioavailability, the way they build up in our bodies, even our sensitivity to them. And in response, we see that chemical exposure can affect the heat tolerance in fish. So fish that are in streams that are getting warmer and hotter are much, much less tolerant of the toxics they're exposed to. So we have this incredible sort of synergy between these two things: ever-increasing global pollution, particularly in our oceans, which we've treated as a global sump for so many years, and ever-increasing climate change. And it really is doing some pretty terrible things to our aquatic and our eco-marine systems.
Yeah, I'm wondering about the warming of the oceans. Everything's getting hotter, and there's a buildup of CO2 in the oceans. Does that present a threat of greenhouse gases boiling out, which apparently they are in under the Arctic shelf or in Siberia? What are the threats of ocean warming on climate change itself?
Well, certainly the oceans are rapidly heating, much faster than the atmosphere. And in the last 30 years, they've heated about 4.5 times faster than they did in the previous 30 years. And you're right, it's the increased heating, the increased CO2 which goes into the ocean and making it so much more acidic, with the salinity levels going up because of the increased heating, oxygen levels going down, which means you have more dead zones, more marine algae blooms. You're really creating a shocking situation for species who are already under risk from all of the pollutants they're exposed to. And so, you know, our concerns when it comes to chemicals with global warming is very much that increased mobilization, because we're seeing now chemicals like PCBs or polychlorinated biphenyls, which are an old-fashioned sort of chemical. Most countries have banned them for many years. We're seeing those levels starting to increase in Antarctic fish and in some parts of the Arctic. Now, we don't think it's because people are using PCBs. We believe it's because they are being increasingly mobilized from ice, snow, sediments. The issue to do with the methane, which is literally escaping from the earth because of the increased temperatures and the melting of the permafrost, that is simply another added factor to the heating of both the atmosphere and the oceans. And while methane is not a toxic chemical as such, it increases global warming, it increases climate change with all of those subsequent impacts. And certainly most people would know now in Australia, we have just had the worst summer ever, with fires that have burnt millions of hectares, and most of that has been put down to the increased risk of climate change. So all in all, it's a pretty terrible situation.
Well, what can be done? You know, there's a whole set of solutions, it seems to me, that our elites are completely avoiding. That scientists say if we really take them, if we reconstruct our economy, there's a good reason that they're not taking it, because they would lose a great deal of wealth and power if we implemented those solutions. But how do we reduce the greenhouse gas emissions and therefore reduce global warming and ocean acidification and all of the impacts that it has?
Well, certainly there is only one solution, and that is the decarbonizing of our economies, which means the removal of fossil fuels and certainly the removal of coal-burning power stations. That, for us, is a major issue, not only because coal is probably one of the biggest contributors to the greenhouse effect and to greenhouse gases, but it's also one of the biggest contributors to mercury. And as most of your listeners would know, mercury is a pretty toxic chemical, and we are now seeing mercury levels increasing. There's been some discussion about them doubling in the North Pacific by 2050. So the good part is that if you attack the issue of coal burning levels increasing, there's been some discussion about them doubling in the North Pacific by 2050. So the good part is that if you attack the issue of coal burning for climate reasons, you also succeed in reducing your toxic exposure. So there's many things we can do to reduce climate change. Whether industries will permit that, whether governments will have the gall to do it, we're at a loss to know. But at the same time, we are going to have to deal with what is here already and the effect that it is having on ocean pollutants now. And we really, as a community, have to change the way we live and change the way we use chemicals, change the way we think about things like plastics, because we have got an awful lot of cleanup that we are going to have to do before we see the benefits of a cleaner ocean and a healthier ecosystem.
This is Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio, talking to Marianne Lloyd-Smith on pollution and its impacts. Marianne Lloyd-Smith developed expertise. She's been on UN panels on climate change and the oceans. Marianne Lloyd, tell us about the different sources of ocean pollution.
Yes, well, as I mentioned, we really do use our ocean as a major global sump, collecting all of our rubbish and our chemicals. And, you know, 80% of that originates on land, from everything from industrial releases to water treatment effluent to mining wastes and, of course, agricultural runoff. And these sort of contaminants get into the ocean via atmospheric transport. That simply means just moving through the air, or runoff into waterways, or even often the case of direct disposal or dumping. One of the chemicals that we are most concerned about are one of those POPs, forever chemicals you mentioned earlier, which are the per or polyfluoroalkyl substances, often known as PFAS or forever chemicals. And some studies that were done quite recently on the surface sea surface microlayer, which is the sort of very top part of the ocean, which is a crucial habitat for fish eggs and larvae of lots of species, including our commercial fisheries, PFAS were contaminating 80% of those surface seawater samples. As well as PFAS, we have everything from the brominated flame retardants, which have been used for years to treat furnishings, you know, mercury and heavy metal compounds as well. Lots of the nonylphenol surfactants and detergents, which are breakdowns of a nonylphenol ethoxylate type chemical. And of course, the oceans and our waterways are besieged by pesticides as well. But one of the real ones that surprised us when we did our work was the level of pharmaceuticals that we found in water. And one figure that I must admit just stunned me was when we looked at something like the Baltic Sea and realized that in that, one pharmaceutical alone that's used to treat epilepsy, there was estimated 55 tons of that was actually in the Baltic Sea and in its sediment. So you can imagine that sort of damage, the damage that those pharmaceuticals can do to wildlife. And so many of the pollutants that we see now are what are called endocrine disrupting chemicals. And those are chemicals that disrupt not only the way species reproduce, but the way they behave, even their immune system. And then, you know, not to be too depressing about it, as well as all of these chemical pollutants, you have this massive amount of microplastics moving into the oceans. And I think it was estimated recently by the UN that 13 million tons of plastic waste enters our oceans every year. And that plastic waste, it carries not only the chemicals that the actual plastic was made out of or had added to it, like phthalates and BPA, but all of the chemicals that it concentrates once it's in the water, because it attracts those same POPs chemicals we've been talking about. So when, for an example, a turtle eats a small amount of microplastics, it also eats the PCBs that have found its way onto those plastics. And we have clear indication of that positive correlation, the amount of plastic ingested by ocean species and the amount of contaminants in them. So it is a pretty grim story when you look at the situation of chemicals and plastics in our oceans today.
Yeah, and in fact, in all waters, I've read about the reproductive problems of amphibians, frogs, and others, and the amount now of fish that are unable to reproduce because their reproductive organs are just not capable of creating the sort of the natural cycle. And frogs are just disappearing fairly rapidly all over the world, is my understanding.
Certainly, and what we do see is fish or amphibian species that live downstream to wastewater outfalls. And by those, I just mean the outfalls from your local municipal sewerage plants that usually pump out their effluent into the closest waterway once it's treated. When we look at male fish downstream of those, we see that they have been feminized, the male fish, and have things like the early stage eggs actually forming in their testes, which, as you say, makes it impossible for them to breed. And this we're seeing, you know, with amphibians and fish in freshwater. We're seeing it in coastal fish, coastal waters, close to rivers that are running off agricultural land. So it is an extremely worrying situation when it comes to endocrine disruptions and marine life. And really it is up to all of us, as well as our governments, to get rid of those pesticides that we know are susceptible to causing these effects in fish and in prawns, to stop using our sewerage farms as a way of getting rid of rubbish, you know, flushing things down the toilet. There is so much that we can all do, but it is a very, very big problem that is going to need an awful lot of work to resolve it.
Yeah, Marianne, we should also talk about the impacts of humans on this huge accumulation of chemicals. And we're, of course, drinking water with all those little plastic beads in them, the microscopic beads that we deposit in our from our toothpaste and many other cosmetic products. But then they get into our water, and we're taking them in as well. They're accumulating faster and faster, and we're also having more sort of reproductive problems, that is, people who find themselves unable to conceive for one reason or another. And this is just the beginning of it, it seems to me, unless we do something very radical.
I agree, and truly when we realize that every baby on this earth is now born with quite often up to a couple of hundred different chemicals in its umbilical cord blood, that should have been enough to shock the globe into waking up. But unfortunately, it hasn't. And so all of us carry our body load of chemicals. We already have associated those body loads for people with high exposure. For example, Inuit people with high POPs in their body have an increased cardiovascular disease, increased high cholesterol levels, diabetes, inflammatory chronic diseases, cancer. So we do have a link between those exposures. Much of those exposures come through food, and a lot of that comes through fish and marine foods, which, as we know, are already contaminated. But yes, there is no question or doubt that the chemicals we are exposed to are having their effect. We're passing them on to the next generation. Every time a mother breastfeeds, unfortunately, we give our firstborn our pretty much our, you know, life history of chemicals. And the only way we can address that is to A, get rid of chemicals that are bioaccumulative and persistent. And we have long argued that if you find a chemical in a baby's body, in a baby's umbilical cord blood, it has no right to be on the commercial market. Unfortunately, we have not won with that argument, and we see more and more, for example, the PFAS chemicals. I think we now have something like 4,700 of them on the market, yet we probably have data on less than 20, 25 of them. So we don't know how bioaccumulative, how persistent, or how toxic many of those chemicals are. And that's something we've argued for a long time. If there's no data on a chemical, then there should be no market for that chemical.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. Bill Resnick talking to Marianne Lloyd Smith, who's developed a huge amount of expertise on the chemical pollutants that are concentrating in the ocean and in our bodies. Marianne Lloyd, it seems to me that getting all these chemicals out of the ocean is almost inconceivable. there's so much water and they're there, and many of them don't decompose in a very long period or not at all. The POPs that you've written about, persistent organic pollutants. On land, it seems to me, though, we have a somewhat better chance of getting water and food, greatly reducing the amount of chemicals that we're bathed in through regenerative agriculture, through not using any of those chemicals like biological efforts to bacteria that eat some of the chemicals, and also organic agriculture of various kinds.
Oh, I certainly think we can do a lot. And as you say, regenerative farming, which, you know, sequesters carbon, restores soil health, and by doing that, it can protect runoff to rivers and oceans. So that certainly is a major thing people can do. We can also look at the types of ecosystem approaches to aquaculture as well. And there's some very interesting work where we've seen open water integrated multi-trophic aquaculture, which simply means having fish farms and seaweed production at the same time growing together so you don't produce waste. Very similar to the sort of principles on which regenerative farming is based. We've also got some wonderful initiatives with circular economy. And I don't mean, you know, the circular economy that industry talks about, which means burning everything at the end, but it's a true circular economy, so that when you produce a product, you know what its life cycle will be. You know what will happen to the end of that, to that product at the end of its life, and it will come back into the circular economy as a form of resource for another product. But to do that, to have a truly circular economy, you have to detoxify it. But because there is absolutely no point in recycling plastic to make new plastic products or recycling other things if they are full of toxic chemicals. And that's exactly what's happened today. When we tested children's toys, we found chemicals in them that should never have been there, and we couldn't work out why until we realized that many of those toys had been made from plastics that had been used in electronics, so were contaminated with brominated flame retardants. So really, to have true economy, circular economy, you have to get rid of the toxics. To get rid of the toxics, we need to get rid of the demand for them, because that's industry's excuse all the time. We only produce what people want, which is absolute rubbish. You know, they produce what they want to sell and give people the least choices possible. And so as consumers and community people, we have to say, no, we will not buy those products. We will not accept that. It's a hard fight. It's a fight that we've been working on now for probably 35, 40 years, and as many, many other community groups across the globe are. But, you know, we can do a lot, and we must do a lot. Otherwise, we're going to leave a very sad and degraded world to our children and grandchildren.
Yeah, and it has to be done fairly quickly, too, because climate change is going to kill all of us if it's not very rapidly reduce greenhouse gas emissions. We have to nourish hope and make demands. At some point, in fact, people are going to wake up, especially to climate change, when Long Island goes underwater and many other places go underwater, and food prices begin spiking and all of the rest, vast fires and droughts. They will wake up. We have to be prepared. We have to do everything we can now, and partly in preparation for that moment when people arise, a huge mobilization, which will, of course, displace our current elites, who will be relegated to rest homes of some kind to contemplate what they've done to the planet. Thanks a lot for talking to us today.
My pleasure.